This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is out today. We'll begin with our week in review and with lessons learned from the Boston Marathon bombings. In Washington this week, there was praise for local law enforcement, but big questions about a post-9/11 security system.
I believe that though it would not have been easy, it was possible to have prevented the terrorist attacks in Boston.
Also this week, the body of one of the suspected bombers is finally buried, but not before a lot of protest and debate.
He belongs in Russia.
Look, this is not a state or a federal matter. It's a family matter.
Everybody in the United States and everywhere in the world has the right to be buried.
They deserve nothing more than to be fed to the sharks.
And this week, the race for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts tightens up.
It's close. If Gomez goes up 3 points and Markey goes down 3 points, you have a tie.
And a new report casts doubt on just how committed many colleges are to economic equality, financial aid for the rich, and heavy debt for those in need.
Colleges are looking for wealthier students, trying to give little merit scholarships to get full-pay students.
All right, and those are some of the stories we'll dive into with two members of our Week in Review team. Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, joins us now, and good to have you back, Callum.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
And joining us from the studios of Rhode Island Public Radio is Scott McKay, political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio in Providence. And Scott, great to have you back.
Greetings from Divine Providence.
Greetings from Divine Providence, indeed. So, gentlemen, let's start with some of these lessons and hearings this week before the House Homeland Security Committee. Lawmakers heard from Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis. And here's an exchange between Davis and Republican Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas about what federal agents knew about one of the suspects, Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Before the bombing, were you aware that based on this Russian intelligence, that the FBI opened an investigation into Tamerlan?
We were not aware of that.
Would you have liked to have known about that?
Yes.
Before the bombing, were you aware that Mr. Tamerlan traveled to the Chechen region?
No, we were not.
Again, would you like to have known that?
Yes.
The committee also heard from former Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, one of the architects of the national counterterrorism system established after 9/11. He suggested that this was the latest failure of public safety officials, failure to connect the dots.
In a literal sense, the Homeland Security system that we built after 9/11 to protect the American people from terrorist attacks failed to stop the Tsarnaev brothers.
So, gentlemen, let's start there. And, Callum, let me come to you first. Lieberman says we should have been able to just stop these attacks. What's your view on where this investigation goes from here?
Yeah, I think that might be a bit of a leap. I think it's a little bit of the hindsight talking, of course. But I think that there clearly is a communications gap here. And I think part of what it comes down to, Anthony, is just this discrepancy between active information sharing and passive information sharing. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we heard the testimony from Ed Davis. The response from the FBI office in Boston was, well, you did have access to all this information. It was right in a database that four of your members have access to as part of the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force. And, of course, that is the case. But we're talking about, you know, one assessment out of 1,000 that was performed just in 2011. So it's a huge sample size. And as Davis said, you know, we could use something more active than that. You got to know what you're looking for.
Right. He said, in fact, he told our reporter, Kurt Nickisch, that they might have well had the information there. Had they known it, it wouldn't necessarily have helped because they know of all kinds of dangerous people and police can't follow all of them all the time. So Scott, what's the lesson, if any, from here?
Well, one of the lessons we all learned from this is how very difficult it is to secure a soft target like the Boston Marathon. Very, very difficult. And I think you've had this report time and again on BUR. And sure enough, we know that you can't follow 1,000 people around every single day. Now, that said, historically, there have always been turf battles among law enforcement agencies. And Boston, between the FBI and the state police, going back to the Whitey Bulger days, was probably one of the worst in the country. However, if you talk with the police people around, I just had a chat yesterday with Providence Police Chief Hugh Clements, and he says that since Rick DeLaurier has taken over as a special agent in charge in Boston, that things are a lot better and there is more cooperation among these various law enforcement agencies. So on the one hand, things seem to be better than they were. But on the other hand, you couldn't stop this tragic bombing.
And let me bring up another theme that Ed Davis brought up. He talked about at the hearing yesterday in Washington the importance of community engagement in cases like this, and he pointed to one example for example, UMass Dartmouth. Nobody came forward to identify Jahar Tsarnaev after the FBI released photos of the suspects. Let's listen to him.
There's no computer that's going to spit out a terrorist name. It's the community being involved in the conversation and being appropriately open to communicating with law enforcement when something awry is identified.
Callum, does that sound like a reasonable takeaway, one of the reasonable takeaways from all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, my paper's editorial board wrote about this subject today, about how the, you know, see something, say something campaign apparently has not fully sunk in. And you know, as the commissioner said, I mean, you can have all this information at your disposal, but it's hard to replace, people. And we saw them, on TV on that, very memorable Friday, people who were playing, club soccer with Jahar Tsarnaev. These are folks who we can only assume you had to be watching the news. You saw the photo. Did you not recognize this guy who was a friend who you hung out with on a regular basis? And if you did, why didn't you speak up? I think it's an absolutely fair question.
I want to spend a quick moment before we put this issue to bed talking about the debate around the disposition of suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev's body. As we know, it lay in limbo for several days in a Worcester funeral home. It was finally interred. We learned today that it was interred in a Muslim cemetery in Virginia. The resolution came after protests in Worcester, after officials in Cambridge and Boston made it clear they would not accept the body. Earlier this week, we talked to the Reverend Fred Small, senior minister of First Parish in Cambridge, Unitarian Universalist. He argued that Cambridge was wrong to give in to this kind of public pressure to reject the burial of the body.
I understand the sensitivities involved, but Tamerlan Tsarnaev is dead. The question now is, what kind of people are we going to be? Will we choose hatred and vengeance, or will we choose compassion? If we choose hatred and vengeance, terrorists win, because they've made us more like them.
Now, that view provoked a huge response at RadioBoston.org. Many listeners applauded Mr. Small. Some took issue with him. What do you make of this argument? Scott, let me start with you.
Well, the Reverend Small obviously would like us to speak, to our better. He's trying to speak to our better angels. And try to put this behind us. On the other hand, he's a man of the clergy, and he's not a law enforcement person or somebody in politics. And, I feel that if you were, say, mayor of Cambridge or a public official in Cambridge, you're probably glad this body's not there simply because of the possibility of mischief, of crazy people trying to dig up the grave. I mean, you can just see, given the emotions that's out there right now in the community, what could happen. And I'm sure that if you're on the political sphere, without being a crazy person, just looking at this very pragmatically and saying, I really don't think this is the time I want this body in my community.
Fair point. Callum Borchers, I know you folks at the Globe editorialized on this issue today. What's your view?
Yeah, I sort of look at the rejections by Boston and Cambridge a little bit differently. Boston's makes sense to me because, really, Tamerlan Tsarnaev have had no real connection to Boston other than, the attack, frankly. Cambridge, however, was his home. And so, logically, if you take the fact that he's a terrorist out of the equation, that's probably where he would have been buried. So, to me, the reaction from folks really not wanting to be buried there is completely understandable, but also slightly disappointing. I think that there's a part of me that agrees with the Reverend Small. This was an opportunity for folks to sort of step up and, show some grace and so show a side of our American society that can rise above the hatred that was shown by these two terrorists. And, a little bit of a missed opportunity there, although, like I said, totally understandable.
Yeah, complicated issue. Absolutely. Let's move on now to the race for the U.S. Senate here in Massachusetts. A WBUR Mass Inc. poll released this week shows Democratic candidate Congressman Ed Markey 6 points ahead of Republican challenger Gabriel Gomez, 41-35%. So it sounds like the race isn't out of reach for Gomez in this very blue state. But as usual, it's those unenrolled voters that are going to determine this election. And Mass Inc. pollster Steve Cosella told us this week for a Republican to win in Massachusetts, he needs to count on a big advantage among those unenrolled voters. And right now, Gomez doesn't have that.
Right now, looking at Gomez and Markey, you have about a tie, actually, which is not good enough for what Gomez is going to need to do. You know, any Republican running statewide starts at the bottom of a hill because they have a 3-to-1 registration disadvantage compared to their Democratic opponent. So how they have to climb that hill is by really running up the score significantly among the unenrolled voters.
Callum, what's your take on this? Because on the one hand, you can look in this poll and say 6 points. Well, that's pretty close. On the other hand, Steve Cozzella described a pretty steep climb for Gabriel Gomez there.
Right. And then, of course, you have the Suffolk poll that shows a gap that's pushing 20 points. So, you know, where is this race really? I think, though, that, you know, he's right on in the point that Gomez clearly needs to widen the margin with unenrolled voters if he is going to steal this election. And it really would be a major upset because there are obvious parallels, right, to Coakley Brown a couple of years ago. But the big part where that, you know, diverges for me is that the Democrats are not going to make the same mistake of underestimating a Republican candidate the way they did in taking this race for granted.
Yeah, Scott, what do you see when you look at these polls? And I'm intrigued by the point that Callum brings up at the end there. Do you see the potential here that this could be another Scott Brown moment or not?
Well, only if the Democrats take this lightly. I don't think they will. A couple of things I think are going on. First of all, there's huge voter fatigue in Massachusetts. Look at the 7% dismal turnout in the primary. Secondly, it's very hard to poll these things. A special election where nobody knows what the turnout is. The demographics are tough to predict. And that's why it's gone from 17 points at Suffolk down to, I think, 4 points in a public policy polling. The other thing you have to understand here is that, like Scott Brown, you know, Gomez is a blank slate. Now, they're starting to try to go after that with Frank Phillips' story today in the Boston Globe about this $281,000 tax credit, and he won't release his tax returns from 2005, and this kind of a dust-up. That said, I think the Democrats are going to have to energize their base. I think that Markey's going to have to work harder than he has to get the Steve Lynch primary voters back in the fold. I think that you're going to see Michelle Obama's going to come in. I would think Joe Biden. I would think the Democrats nationally have to make this a race about how important it is to keep this Senate seat blue, given what's going on in Washington. The other thing, if I was Ed Markey, I'd be a little careful about, you know, the bragging about the technological and the telecommunications stuff. If I was him, I'd be out there saying, here's what I'm going to do for Worcester and Springfield and New Bedford and Haverhill and Fall River. I really think that, you know, given the lack of seniority in the Mass Senate delegation now, I think Markey, who's been in Washington for over two decades, has to get out there and say, look, I'm the guy who knows how to be an honest broker for Massachusetts. And that's something that, you know, really since Ted Kennedy died, there hasn't been in the Massachusetts congressional delegation. So there's a bunch of challenges here. But don't forget, it's very hard to poll a low turnout election. And don't forget how Brown won. Brown won this with fewer votes. He won a Senate race with fewer votes than John McCain got in Massachusetts in losing by a landslide in the 2008 presidential election. So you can see what the challenge is there.
Sure. Challenge. Indeed. Let's move on. I want to move on to a troubling report this week that raised questions about just how committed many colleges are to economic equality. It came from the nonpartisan New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. And the takeaway is this. Many colleges and universities are using financial aid, merit scholarships, tuition reductions to attract wealthy students while forcing many poor students to pay much more than they can afford and take on heavy debt. Here's Steve Byrd. He's author of the report. He told us the federal government gives out over $35 billion in Pell Grants, and he makes the charge that many colleges aren't doing their part to help low-income students.
Changes in the incentive structure built into Pell Grants to try to change the behaviors of colleges. It seems that the schools are so steeped in this sort of intense competition for the best and wealthiest that it's unlikely they'll be able to do it on their own.
So what do you think, Callum Borchers, what does this point to? He talks about changes in the incentive structure are needed. What might those be, or what's your takeaway from this report?
Well, I was thinking about what the changes could be, and I think that one of the challenges you end up with here, right, is that the colleges get so much financial information about their applicants through the FAFSA, and I wonder if there could be some kind of dividing line where if you are applying for some type of merit-based scholarship, right, because that's really what we're talking about in a lot of ways, is it's a subtle way of attracting higher-income students. But at the same time that you're evaluating a student for a, quote, merit-based scholarship, your admissions office also is privy to a lot of financial information about that applicant. And I think that that maybe is an opportunity where you could have a department, you know, within an applications office that the merit-based folks are strictly looking at the grades and SAT scores and your essay and that sort of thing. And then, you know, the FAFSA is going to the folks who are actually looking at the need-based aid. And maybe that's a difficult thing to separate, but that might sort of level the playing field a little bit.
Some of these figures, Scott, that this report looked at, and they got these figures from the U.S. Department of Education, it found that nearly two-thirds of the private institutions charge low-income students, and that would be families that make $30,000 a year or less, a net price of more than $15,000 a year. In other words, they're paying more than 50% of their family income for college. So this is a real issue.
Yeah, it's really terrible because colleges are supposed to be competing for the smartest students, we hope, and the best-rounded students or the best athletes or whatever, and not those with the most money. Now, that said, this isn't entirely new. College admissions, as we all know, have never been a pure meritocracy. Colleges are full of legacies. They're full of athletes, someone who plays the oboe. It's not just on SAT scores and grades. We all know that. But that said, I think it points to something that really, really has hurt education and social mobility in this country, and that is the lack of investment, particularly in our good state public universities. I mean, if you look at the tuition increases around the country, and even in New England, you'll find that because of the recession and the lack of support for state universities, for public education, that some of these good institutions are now pricing poor and working class students out of an education. And that is sad and really almost unprecedented in the last 50 or 60 years in this country.
Hmm. Well, certainly an issue that we're going to do some more work on next week on Radio Boston. An important issue and one that affects a lot of families. Gentlemen, our time is about to run out. I want to leave time for the hubbub, that story that fell below the fold that maybe we should have paid a little more attention to. Callum, let me come to you first for your hubbub this week.
Well, this story literally was below the fold, but I spent my Tuesday morning this week over at the State House for a hearing on conducting a feasibility study to bring the Olympics to Boston in 2024. Mm. We've heard some rumblings about this, right? And there were a lot of excited folks there. And you got the support of several members of the city council. There's a private group that is trying to raise private dollars to pay for this study so you can lift that tax burden. And let me introduce you to a name if you're not familiar with this already. The name is Dan Walsh. He is a former Olympic rower, Northeastern University grad. And if this movement catches any steam, expect to see him popping up a lot. Of all the speakers who testified at this hearing, he really stood out as eloquent. He also stood out because he's 6'7". And the way that he was able to paint a picture of the Olympic spirit that he had shared with folks as he was passing his medal around Fenway Park, on his victory tour, so to speak, and sort of spreading that to the entire Commonwealth, that was powerful stuff. So look for him, Dan Walsh.
Dan Walsh. Well, we will remember that. Scott McKay, let me come to you for
It's interesting because the F-bomb that was dropped by Big Poppy, David Ortiz of the Red Sox, at Fenway Park right after the bombing, after the marathon, was like the F-bomb heard around the world. And he went on a tear and started hitting, I believe, over 500. Well, a couple of weeks later, now his average is tapered off. He seems to be coming back down to earth. So I'm wondering, is it time for Big Poppy to drop another F-bomb?
Okay. Well, I'm not going to comment on that one, but it's an interesting idea. So here's my hubbub, and it's a little more serious. It's about homelessness and how the homeless can be invisible to many of us. And while there are signs that the economy is much improved for many, there are still big pockets of poverty out there and millions of folks who are struggling, easily overlooked. We were reminded of that this week when authorities began clearing three separate homeless camps out along the banks of the Merrimack River near Lowell. On the one hand, one can understand the concerns of public safety officials, but on the other, This points to big underlying problems that need to be addressed. Some of these people have been living outside under tarps for years. And while some of them will be moved into shelters and transitional housing, there won't be room for all of them, which is why advocates for the homeless told the Lowell Sun this week, there needs to be housing first before you remove people. So we're going to end there. And Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, Scott McKay, political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio. Thank you both for coming in. Have great weekends. Gentlemen, thank you.
And hey, thanks a lot, Anthony.
Thank you.
You're the man.
It's all about you, Scott. Stay with us. Still ahead, the history, the biology of thrills, fear, and fight or flight. A new book about the history of adrenaline. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.